Welcome to the Colorado Review podcast, featuring prose and poetry from both recent and archived issues of the journal. Once a month, a rotating crew of editors and staff members are invited to read and discuss some favorite stories, poems, or essays published at Colorado Review. I'm Kylan Rice, joined today by Sasha Steenson, poetry editor for the journal and professor at Colorado State University. Today, we've invited Melissa Hull on board, who has selected several poems from the fall 2014 issue of Colorado Review. So, Melissa and Sasha, thanks a lot for joining me today. It's a pleasure to be with you on this snowy morning, focusing on Julie Carr and translations by Rosemary Waldrop of L.K. Erb. So, Melissa, I'm just curious, what drew you to these two poets in particular?
Well, I did want to work with the ladies. That's something that I had in mind when I was looking through this most recent issue of the Colorado Review. And I've always been interested in translation because I speak about like 11th grade Spanish, and that's not enough to, I think, translate poems.
Seems pretty good.
11th grade, yeah. Most
Americans don't have 8th grade reading levels, yeah. So I think 11th grade yeah. Spanish is pretty good.
Most of them speak 11 words.
So I've always been interested in the idea of translation, especially because it seems a bit out of my reach at this point. And then I was drawn to the Carr poems, first of all, because of the titles, second of all, because I first encountered Julie Carr when I studied at Naropa for a summer. I did the summer program, I think in like 2011 or something like that. And she was there, and the girl that I was staying with at Naropa was taking Julie Carr's workshop, and just the things that Julie Carr had them do in the workshop were so amazing to me. Like, one of the things that she had them do was walk around the room to, like, a beat, to their own beat, and find out what instrument they were. And my roommate found out she was, like, a trumpet or something. And Julie Carr just had these amazing, like, really physical, almost, like, performance, I guess, things that she wanted these people to do. And so I was drawn to her then as well.
And she was a dancer. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah, she was. I was reading about that, and that actually ties into a quote that I brought from her.
And is that a quote you want to save for later, or?
I could. I'll save it for later.
Okay, cool. Well, Sasha, have you had much experience with her and her work?
Yes, actually. We are sort of like reading tour partners. Oh. Next week, we're going to Chicago and Iowa City. In the spring, we went, like 5 or 6 different places on the East Coast. So, yeah, she's a friend, and I'm very pleased that she's here because I'm like Melissa, drawn to her work and interested in many of the concerns that she has.
Cool. Well, without revealing too much about the poems, why don't we begin by reading one of the poems in the series, I Like America and America Likes Me, published in the fall-winter 2014 issue of Colorado Review.
All right, I'll read the first one first. The titles are the same, so we'll just go with the first one. I like America, and America likes me. Friends, countrymen, one of these men is lying, and though we care for one another, we'll never agree about which one it is. The smile of lying and the smile of catching another in a lie are identical smiles. Friends, countrymen, let us turn to the metaphysical sublime. Should we raise the mother to the dignity of the thing? I need my glasses. I need my girls. Friends, countrymen, the choice is clear before us. Intense wind through the night, setting off sirens down the avenues, sirens in the cars. I dreamed myself back to childhood, as if in a self made of sand on fire, though so rarely do we speak of love.
Thank you. Both of these poems bear the title, and we'll hear the second in a moment, but both of these poems bear the title, I Like America and America Likes Me. Now, I understand that there's a backstory behind this particular title.
Yes, there is. So, like I said before about, like, the performance thing that Carr had my roommate do at Naropa. It ties in really well with this title, actually, I Like America and America Likes Me, because these twin titles are actually the title of a 1974 performance piece by a German artist named Joseph, I think it's pronounced Boys, Joseph Boys. So his work is super extensive. He was part of a Fluxus group. He was a happening and a performance artist, a sculptor, a graphic artist, and the list just goes on and on. And so what he did, what Boys did in his performance piece, I Like America and America Likes Me, he flew to America from Germany. He got directly on a stretcher into an ambulance. He hung out in a room for 3 days in some building in America. I'm sure there's a specific building, but I don't know it. He hung out in a building in America for 3 days with a wild coyote, and then he got back onto the stretcher, into the ambulance, back on the plane to Germany, and he never set foot on American soil. So that is the backstory that I find super interesting and also slightly dangerous, yeah, but pretty awesome. And so I was wondering, about that title.
Yeah, so we have in this particular poem the repeated phrase, friends, countrymen, right, which is, you know, a famous phrase. It immediately pops to my mind sort of notions of rhetoric and political speech giving, tied to the notion of the nation, you know, politics in general. And I wonder if you could maybe talk about tying this Joseph Boys piece to this poem by way of perhaps that connective ligament of the phrase friends, countrymen.
I was thinking about the fact that, you know, it sort of comes from Julius Caesar, and of course at Shakespeare it's friends, Romans, countrymen, right? Mm. And this of course is friends, countrymen. I'm thinking of the ways in which Rome is, you know, historically the model being a republic and not a democracy is actually much closer in many ways to our model, right? We think of ourselves as having a democracy, but in fact we really have a republic. And when we use the democracy term loosely, it's appropriate. But when we really think about the way that we actually elect people to make our decisions, that seems really important. But as you're saying, Kylan, in terms of the rhetoric and this idea of the speech and the address of one's countrymen, I'm thinking about Boy's sort of gesture toward America, where he comes, but he doesn't set his foot. And also, when I've seen the videos, it looks like he's blindfolded, or
he has like a blanket over his head.
Yeah,
or something.
It looks as though he's not actually seeing either. So like, it's not penetrating him. And I'm thinking that, you know, for him that was probably really important. It was like a sort of like safety measure in a way, right? So how do you address something that you feel is also dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. He, of course, was an outsider and not like a countryman, right? Mm-hmm. And Carr is. And to me, that seems also important, though I remember reading, too, at the end of that performance, the coyote allows him to touch him and hug him, actually. Mm-hmm. And so that seemed to me to be like this, you know, like this desire to have a real intimacy and connection to a place, even though that place is dangerous, right? Mm. And I think that the Vietnam War was an important reason why, you know, he wasn't going to, in the history of war in general, he wasn't going to actually have actual contact. But how could he? The coyote is an American coyote, right? It's a way to have contact. So that seemed, and this is a poem about contact in many ways.
Right.
And it's a poem about how to create that kind of intimacy, though so rarely do we speak of love, but also protect oneself and one's loved ones, I think.
Yeah, that question of contact and a way to create contact seems definitely central to this poem. Especially, we have a variety of pronouns floating around. Primarily, the pronoun, first-person plural pronoun, we, and then of course, first-person singular pronoun, I. And I think that's interesting in a poem, a poem that is concerned with rhetoric, with speech giving, with connectivity, that we have this relationship explored between the I and the we in an interesting fashion. You know, the formation of the I, formation of identity, seems very important, mm-hmm, to this particular poem.
Mm-hmm. And also that moment in the middle, let us turn, you know, like so that there is an I and there's a we that The eye remains somewhat apart, even though the eye is part of a we. But at that moment, let us turn together toward this thing, even though we have, like, you know, such different values potentially. And that seems to me to be like this really beautiful rhetorical moment too.
Why don't we take a look at the second poem? Melissa, would you mind reading that for us?
I like America and America likes me. Having allowed myself to be blunt, I now turn to language as an ornamental machine. Oh, I would like to entrust myself to words, naked words, and to speak these words without repeating myself. Philosophers write, I repeat. But first I must tell a story. The fox held a feast underground for all the diggers. We never have to go outside again. Everyone cheered. We will never be shot at again. In this underground home with secret pathways to food, the animals will always be safe. Forever, they shout, forever. Meanwhile, the men with guns on their laps wait forever, hunched in their camping chairs in the rain. Guns ready, but nothing left to shoot. Am I a woman only to the extent that I am willing to be naked with such naked words as these? The medievalist makes an appointment with the president. The philosopher flies over Germany. The public health advocate joins him mid-air. The grief counselor speaks to the reporter while waiting for her flight in Asheville. And I am conducting a survey of social malaise. Tying his tennis shoe, the old man glances up.
Thank you so much. I think it's remarkable that this poem begins in language. The first line, I now turn to language as an ornamental machine. So it seems to me perhaps significant that Carr is prefacing the poem in this fashion with sort of a meditation on language itself. I wonder if you have any thoughts on how Carr is arguing that language functions not only in this poem, but perhaps in the world of the poem, the situation of the poem, if these poems are sort of politically torqued, and how language is operating on a political level seems to me to be sort of central to these pieces. So I wonder, is language operating as an ornamental machine in these poems, or is it fulfilling some other function as well?
Well, I was thinking a lot about the nature of, like, the divisiveness of language. And I was thinking about something Adrian Rich says, which is that the same language that entraps us will eventually liberate us, or could eventually liberate us, which is different than something like Audre Lorde's "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house," right? Which I have a lot of admiration for both sort of positions. I feel like in this poem, language is being considered as ornament on the one hand, but notice the women are naked, right? And the men are completely outfitted with their hunting gear. And so there's this simultaneous, I believe, skepticism about language as ornament going on here, just as a poet would be interested in language as ornament, right? And so it seems like she doesn't, like, give us, you know, the binary of either or, rather, but helps us to see the ways in which language as ornament can be both an entrapping and a liberating tool, and that perhaps a kind of nakedness is a place to begin, or even though it begins with, I now turn to language as an ornamental machine, but we notice that, you know, toward the end of the poem, these naked women, we might start considering it as an ornamental machine, but we're going to move toward this kind of nakedness as a sort of, counterposition, potentially.
I mean, what I thought that was really interesting about the way language was working in this poem was that, fourth stanza, but first I must tell a story. And I think that that's really interesting that falls, you know, after the second stanza, oh, I would like to entrust myself to words, naked words. You know, and then there's another stanza, but first I must tell a story. And so it's like she would like to entrust, the speaker would like to entrust themselves to words, naked words, but first they must tell a story. And so, you know, that I think begs the question of, like, you know, what is a story, like, if not words, what do we expect from a story in a way that, I don't know, that's different from naked words or something like that. So I was really fixated on that moment, but first I must tell a story.
And you have mentioned that that Carr is interested, at least historically, in what it means to write an American poem. And perhaps you could speak to how you feel that being accomplished in these poems, perhaps on the level of language. Does the notion of the story or this particular kind of story factor into that at all?
Okay, well, when I was, like, looking up things about this title, something that came up was, like, a quote, and it really bothers me. There's no date on this website or this quote, so I have no idea when Julie Carr said this. It could have been 10 years ago, but maybe it was yesterday. So a quote from Carr on the Poetry Society of America's website, and I guess I can read I'll read the whole thing. I think it's important. In 1989, I watched Steve Paxson and Lisa Nelson perform a dance called Part, P-A-R-T. Paxton in sunglasses, Nelson in a mustache. The piece was set to a score that included text, and though I have no memory of this text, what I remember is the fact of the language and the way in which the language and movement came together or did not. It was loose, it was open, it left a lot to the imagination. This was the beginning of a very particular aesthetic education, one that is, I believe, uniquely American in its love of the unknown and unknowable, the incomplete, the in progress, the new. I think of that moment of reading, listening, watching as an initiation of sorts, for it prepared me for the work of Ashbery, Cage, Schuller, Hajinian, McLowe, Miles. That particular aesthetic education that began in the theaters and dance studios allows me to read Dickinson, Crane, or Guest in particular ways and pushes me towards the work of my peers that most inspires me, sets me off balance. To be off balance might be a specifically American pleasure. And so after thinking about that quote, right, movement and performance is obviously really key there. But really what stuck out to me in relation to these two poems is the focus on the unknown, the incomplete, the in progress. And I love the very last line of this second, I like America and America likes me, really does end in the in progress, which I thought was very interesting. Tying his tennis shoe, the old man glances up, right? That's something that's in progress. And I just think that's an amazing image to end on, because I too really like to write about the daily, as you guys both know. And so I was really drawn to that line and that being like an in progress, an ending that's in progress, which is pretty fascinating to me.
Well, it seems interesting that it's not only that a story is in progress, but the identity in this poem seems to be struggling to articulate the progress, or it's that it is, you know, going through its trajectory. That is especially the case, I think, in the first poem, in which there seems to be a kind of, you know, I dream myself back to childhood. There seems to be a kind of like personal history occurring, running parallel to this meditation on sort of the language of citizenry, the language of the polis, you know, people. So it's interesting. I think that Carr is meditating in many ways, using sort of this American trend towards incompletion, meditating on how identity is formed, perhaps not only in language, but perhaps in and among representatives or in a milieu of representation.
And also via movement. I mean, that seems really important to me. The American as off balance seems like a crucial image and a crucial idea, because if we think about sort of just, you know, the sort of European colonization, like the incredible, like, unbalance or imbalance of that movement, and then how people, you know, that we think of as like quintessential American poets, like William Carlos Williams and Charles Olson, and, you know, are like intentionally and very deliberately registering movement of their bodies over the landscape in their most important poems again and again. That seems like something that Americans are, you know, very interested in.
Why don't we take a look at some of the poems by Elke Erb? Melissa, would you mind reading A Sign from Elsewhere?
Yes, I will definitely do that. A Sign from Elsewhere, translated from the German by Rosemary Waldrop. My imaginary mother, from time to time, utters a high note, a sign of deeply sated life. But it's deceptive, she is. No more she is. A soprano since she emigrated. With greetings to Franz Hojak, 28 February, 94.
So, you know, this, it's only upon this reading of the poem that I've really paid attention to that last sort of line with greetings to Franz Hojak, 28 February, 94. Are we to make of this poem, is this poem some kind of postcard, some kind of sign from elsewhere as a postcard, and it's supposed to be conceived of in that, in those ways? Is that how you guys read it?
Well, I definitely, I mean, I feel like there's a reaching out from this poem, like a quite obvious reaching out that, you know, we don't find in many poems. So, you know, when you use the word postcard, that feels kind of right to me. I never thought of it that way. I did feel the reaching out, but when you say postcard, that seems right.
Hmm. Yeah, and it feels like it parallels in some way the immigration.
Right.
You know, that it's being sent back, you know, like from a place that the mother has immigrated and presumably had the speaker, you know, and that it's being sent back to kind of the originary place that, you know, the mother originally came from. That's sort of how I read it. I thought too about this third thing that's created. It seems to me, you know, like the imaginary mother that in some ways is not the actual mother, but is also, you know, just to call her imaginary is to imagine that she shares some characteristics with a mother that the speaker has had.
Right.
You know, and that something is transformed, you know, via the immigration. She's a soprano, right? Since she's immigrated, that this third thing is created, and that in that sense, the poem becomes a third thing that's created in a way that's sent back.
Right. Yeah, that seems remarkable to me that it almost, with the first line, we are made to doubt, you know, everything that follows in the poem. Mm-hmm. You know, made to doubt the veracity of everything that follows in the poem, mm-hmm. even though it almost borders on the confessional with my, so mm-hmm. Any old confessional poet and poem mm-hmm. can begin, you know, with my mother, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, but this is my imaginary mother. And these poems themselves are so sort of bound up in our concepts of language. These are very, like, linguistically mm-hmm. Attuned, centered poems. And so it's interesting to me that that the poem owns up at the very first that everything in this piece will be manufactured to a certain extent. There will be deception, you know, these lines, but it's deceptive. She is no more. She is. I don't know. Is that how you guys sort of, Melissa? Is that how you treated the imaginary quality of the mother? I mean, how did you reconcile the imaginary?
Well, when you ask that question, you know, like what happens to the sign in this poem? My immediate reaction when I was like typing up notes was like the sign can't be trusted, and I have absolutely like no like at the time like I had no idea why that was my initial reaction, but it was. And maybe it's because the word deceptive stands out in that poem, especially, like, I think juxtaposed with the word imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two things sort of, like, I guess, conflated for me in a moment. And that's what, that you know, I feel like it can't be trusted. But I also feel like these poems are really magical, you know, like, even though they're so grounded in language, they come off as so magical to me.
Yeah, and we'll read the next poem, different as Hansen and Irwin, I think has some of that magic you're talking about. But before we leave A Sign from Elsewhere, you know, this poem does talk about immigration. It does talk about this sort of transition from place to place, this idea of the elsewhere, all sort of bound up in the question of language. Place and language seems to me to be at the heart of this poem, and interestingly enough, these poems are translated, mm-hmm. which it seems to me at least a happy coincidence that, you know, the genre of translation, if one could call it a genre, is also concerned with this idea of placement, the elsewhere, and language. Now, Melissa, I understand that you've been doing some thinking about, you know, how translation is perhaps functioning in these poems.
Well, when I was thinking about translation in relation to these poems specifically, you know, the language transforms itself so very quickly in these short lines, and this poem's not very long. But, you know, like, she is repeated twice, but of course, like, the second time that we see it, it carries a whole new weight, I guess, than the first time. And so there's something about this translation. I mean, Rosemary Waldrop is, like, translating a transformation of language, which to me is very interesting because, like I said, you know, these poems are magical. There's transformation, and I totally feel that and see that in this first poem, A Sign from Elsewhere. There's a transformation that Rosemary Waldrop is translating. And so this whole, like, trans, I guess, business.
And this magicality you're talking about, I really want our listeners to sort of get a taste of that. So if you could actually read the following three poems, Different as Hansen and Irwin, A Dictionary Is, and Hello, Jürgen Becker.
Different as Hansen and Irwin. When I reach my spot in the park and, getting off my bicycle, think, today the birches are luminous, for they shine out of their surroundings. It is an attempt, no, my usual exercise, to enter into the just now, potentially present, puzzle of language and sketch in it. The sentence, today the birches are luminous, never mind that it's only the trunks that are luminous, would indicate completely different findings or facts on another planet. A dictionary is, after all, only inferred from the sounding of sound existence, hence a rather approximate, somewhat respectively, piano. Hello, Jürgen Becker. A buzzard eye, sailing, pulls together, overlaps views, I follow. A palimpsest is neither composition nor life, I projection, for the buzzard flies in the vertex, as we mathematicians said when we still existed.
I feel a little bit like a buzzard, actually, in these poems, because the reaction to these poems, I feel, is somehow, the only proper reaction is the circling, and a circling somewhat above of the actual poem. It seems to me that they are so densely knit and net and knotted with sort of these questions and sort of intellectual forays that it's really pleasing experience to sort of pick at them. Kind of like a buzzard, right?
Yeah.
To pick them apart and to gain some nourishment from them. So I'm wondering if we could talk specifically about Different as Hansen and Irwin, because I think there's a lot there. What do you guys make of this phrase, to enter into the just now potentially present puzzle of language? Because that seems to me to be the thesis of the poem, so to speak, if I could be so blunt. What is the potentially present, or even the just now potentially present puzzle of language, perhaps as this poem investigates?
I think I would say that there's different ways of, you know, I think that's, I was thinking about it both from the position of the reader, you know, this poem is a potentially present puzzle of language, right? But also from the perspective of the writer, you know, in that the writer writes this sentence, today the birches are luminous. And then the writer writes that sentence again.
Mm.
The sentence, today the birches are luminous, is sort of a way, I think, to enter that sentence twice. And, you know, in entering it twice, a kind of puzzle emerges that might not have emerged had the poet only entered it once.
Mm.
And that, you know, there's this kind of latent quality, unless specifically handled. You know, like, it's like when once one specifically handles this sentence again after, you know, an interlude of other things, including this phrase we're talking about. It is like as if the thing becomes enlivened in a different way. And I was thinking about the buzzard, actually, you know, sort of circling around, sort of waiting for the thing that was just living, that was just spotted, to finally die, so that you know, you could, as you say, get some nourishment from it, right? But in doing so, it becomes alive again in a different way, right? It becomes nourishment. So that image was really striking to me, and putting them together was really kind of fascinating.
Well, it's interesting. So many different worlds are layered on top of each other in this poem. There's the world that's being purportedly described, right? The world in which the birches are really luminous today. And then there's the world of the poem, and then the world of language, all sort of layered on top of each other.
And then we have this another planet at the end, right? There's another fourth world out there.
Findings or facts on another planet. So it's sort of like the signification that can be tunneled through using this phrase.
Yeah.
But the fact that at first the speaker gets off the bicycle, thinks today the birches are luminous, and then, as Sasha, as you said, the sentence is repeated, but this time attention is brought to this phrase as, you know, as a sentence, as a passage of language. It seems to me a kind of palimpsesting is occurring, this kind of inscribing of language onto the real world, and that perhaps how language, like how a phrase of language, like for instance, today the birches are luminous, can actually may or may not be able to make the birches luminous. And of course, we talk about palimpsest a little bit later in
Hello,
Jürgen Becker.
Yeah, and in that moment, a palimpsest is neither composition nor life. Again, so it's like this third thing, that's this excessive thing that's created. And I think that the very first poem we talked about by her is a poem that is about sort of like that third thing that's created via the sign and the signifier, and that there's like something in between that has to constantly be addressed and grappled with. Mm. And so that it's not composition, it's not life, it's not sign, it's not signifier. What is it?
Right. So, and this just pops into my mind, as much as I love talking about sort of like language theory and sort of theory in general, mm-hmm. one must ask oneself, why is this sort of, you know, highfalutin linguistic theory being talked about in the form of a poem? Like, and what makes these perhaps pleasurable to read on their own, apart from the theorizing that they're enacting? Do you guys have any thoughts on this? Like, what is it about these poems that is working apart from their sort of meditation on language, which could be done in prose, you know?
Yes, but of course it would be done differently, and it would... The third thing that would be created wouldn't... I mean, I think it does go back to Melissa's observation that these are magical poems, mm-hmm. right? That, like, on some level, you know, this kind of activity that we're doing and that is being done in the poems is in fact, like, you know, bringing out of the invisible world something, you know, that we can now see is mm-hmm. visible. And that is incredibly exciting to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the word, like, conjuring also, like, comes to mind with these poems for sure. They conjure something for me, which I don't, you know if that could happen in prose. I mean, I'm sure it could, but it would be a different kind of thing, right, that came out of the conjuring. So yeah, like I was really drawn to these poems initially because they, I mean, I think for the most part, maybe use concrete language, and then they somehow make that concrete language very magical. There's transformation, and now I'm thinking about, you know, conjuring, which sort of I think implies both magic and transformation.
Did you see that in one particular poem?
Yeah,
one that we haven't read yet.
I was actually going to ask if I could read. I think this is the fourth poem mm-hmm. or the fifth one. A Rhyme on Ever.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A Rhyme on Ever. The bushes, the brambles, the clumps of wild roses and round sloes have torn our gaze forever into bushes, brambles, roses, and sloes.
It's by far my favorite poem in the mm-hmm. set, I think.
I absolutely love this poem so much. And I mean, I love this poem because, I mean, it seems so simple, but it's not, right? These are simple ideas that actually are very slippery, especially as these words are repeated. Mm. You know, we have bushes three times in that poem. We have everything else basically twice. And then the singular, just once, our gaze, right? Which I love that that's like a plural, you know, it's plural, it's ours, but there's only one, right? There's one gaze. And I was thinking about how the outside acts on the inside with this poem, or perhaps it could be the other way around, but in this case, it does seem like the outside is acting upon the inside. So if you guys have any thoughts about that or...
Well, I was incredibly drawn, of course, to the word slow and how it, in translation, of course, it's the opposite of fast, just as it is this particular blackthorn shrub that is can be used in so many different ways. Like the idea of usefulness was really fascinating to me because, again, there's like this sense of excessiveness in the poem, like the bushes, mm-hmm. right? The slows, which are... you know, don't technically rhyme because they're the same word. You know, it can't right. actually be a rhyme, but also we are asked in some way to think about it as rhyme from the title. And so I was thinking about the ways in which, like, this seems like on the surface, this poem seems very much like a poem about just sort of like the beauty of language. Like, what's beautiful? Repeating bushes is beautiful. Mm-hmm. What's beautiful? Repeating slows is beautiful. The way that word looks is beautiful. You know, it's incredibly oddly ornate poem, even as it is so short. Mm-hmm. Yet, like, to think about the way that these things can be used, right? So the slow can be used apparently to make wine, to make gin, to keep cattle out because of the nature of how thorny it is, you know, it's a very useful and yet sort of unapproachable kind of, it repels in a way, mm-hmm. this, like going back to the idea of the inside and outside, it repels what's outside, but potentially also what's inside. So in that way, like the idea of beauty is being referenced as potentially, you know, repellent, but also as porous, I think, and useful.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Melissa and Sasha, for discussing these poems with me. And thanks also to our listeners for, you know, dealing with the sound of the snowplows passing outside and sticking with us through that. So
thank you, Kylan.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast, which can be found at iTunes and at Colorado Review's website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. I'm Kylan Rice. Thanks for listening.